Hello, friends. Welcome to Out of This World Radio with your host, Ted Marr, broadcasting from the studios of KKNW on 1150 AM here in beautiful Bellevue, Washington, just outside Seattle in the United States. The purpose of this program is to raise consciousness and make this world a much better and happier place. And I know that with everyone's help, we can and will make this earth a much better and happier place. I want to thank everyone so much for listening today and for making Out of This World Radio one of the most popular talk shows in the Seattle area and the fastest growing metaphysical and spiritual radio program in the world with over 200,000 listeners in over 80 countries. During both our day from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. Seattle time, I'll be interviewing a fascinating man named David Adair, who is part of the Secret Space Program. He's a fascinating gentleman, and I'm so happy he'll be on my program. I interviewed him recently at the UFO Fest in Yum, Washington, and we'll be playing that interview in just a few minutes. Before we start, I'd like to thank everyone so much for their support for this program, because Out of This World and corner of the program webpage at www.outofthisworld1150.com and just click on it. I really appreciate your help and support because I know together we can and will create a much better and happier world. I'd also like to thank the many sponsors of this show and also let people know we're looking for additional sponsors and advertisers. Any advertising on the program would have a worldwide audience for your goods and services. With that, I'd like to thank my dear friend Carol, who's been designing my website, providing wonderful support, my friends in the Galactic Alliance, who've been supporting my show, my angelic and earthly family, and KKNW, without whose help and support this program would not be possible. I also have a spiritual mentoring program where I teach people how to contact their angels and spirit guides. If you'd like to get in touch with your loved ones who passed on or contact your angelic guides and get some good spiritual advice, please email me at outofthisworld1150@gmail.com. You can also call me here in the United States at 509-750-9793 or toll-free at 1-888-879-8339. A dear friend of mine passed away recently. His name's Wally Brown. Wonderful man. Please send lots of love and light to his family, and there will be also a memorial and celebration of life for Wally at the City Park in Rainier, Washington on Saturday, August 11th at 4:30 p.m. Please come if you can. My next Galactic Wisdom Conference will be held at the same location in Olympia, Washington, here in the United States from April 12th to the 16th, 2019. We'll have some amazing people, including Aaron Elizabeth of Health Nut News, as well as Simon Parks, who will be giving presentations. If you register before November 1st, 2018, the cost for the three-day conference will be only $55. And if you'd like to register, please send me an email to outofthisworld1150@gmail.com or just call me, please, at 509-750-9793. In addition, next month, from September 6th to the 12th, I'll be taking a group of people to Mount Shasta, Telos, and the Hollow Earth. I've been sponsoring trips to Mount Shasta and the Hollow Earth for the last 2 or 3 years, and it's a wonderful opportunity to visit Telos and the Hollow Earth. I just returned from a trip that I had taken in early July, and when we were there, we actually saw Sasquatch in this dimension, and the Sasquatch built a beautiful peace mandala made up of rose quartz rock crystals just outside of our campground. The camping's free. It's included in the cost. And we always see also lots of UFOs and also meet with the people of Telos on our trip. The cost is just $200. And if you'd like to go, please send me an email or give me a call at 509-750-9793. Several days ago, Facebook and YouTube both banned Alex Jones. And although sometimes I don't agree with Alex Jones, I do appreciate his freedom of speech and the ability to try to tell the truth about what's going on in the world. And I wanted to read this quote from a Protestant priest who existed, who lived during the 30s and 40s when Adolf Hitler was prime minister of Germany. And he wrote that he said his name is Martin Niemöller. And he said, first they came for the socialists and I didn't speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. He ended up spending the last 8 years of World War II in a Nazi concentration camp. And what's bothering about YouTube and Facebook banning Alex Jones, they banned him just simply because, not because he was saying anything illegal, not because he was saying anything against the law, but because they didn't like his opinion. And that is against, totally against the First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States. And I hope
that people will sue both Facebook and YouTube, and at least they'll change their minds and allow them back on. When companies like that start determining who can speak on their networks, it clearly violates the First Amendment, and it's something that goes totally against the U.S. Constitution. With that, I'd like to bring in my good friend David Adair. David Adair, I interviewed him recently at the wonderful UFO Fest here in Yelm, Washington. He was a child genius. At age 6 or 7, he started reading science books about space, and he had a photographic memory. And by age, I think it was like 13 or 14, the U.S. Air Force actually gave him a captured extraterrestrial UFO for him to figure out how to work it. And what happened is that the UFO itself, he told me during the interview, had a brain. It was partially machine and partially organic. And when he put his hand on it, the thing started up. So this interview is fascinating. He's a wonderful gentleman. I really like David Adair. And if we could play that interview now, it'll run through the end of the hour, and then I'll be coming on at the end of this hour to talk more about his interview. So, Nathan, if you could please start his interview now, that would be great.
Hello, friends. I'm with David Adair today at the UFO Fest here in beautiful Yelm, Washington. And, David, thank you so much for coming on my show.
Sure, it's no problem. Glad to be here.
You were telling me something a minute ago that the manned space program is now completely gone. I know my listeners would love to hear about that.
Yeah, such an asinine day was the day that they put all the space shuttles into museums. And my reply for that is, if you'd buy a brand new car and you drive it only 33% of its life, and then you throw the car in a junkyard, would you do that? Of course not. That's exactly what you did with the space shuttle fleet. When the shuttles went into the museums, they had 66% of their life left, and they just threw them into the mothballs. Then they went down to the Cape, pad 37A and B, where you launch the space shuttles. You have all the big gantry towers and support mechanisms and everything. They cut it up with cutting torches, and all that's gone. It's just a slab of concrete down there now. So the manned space program is gone. There is no such thing anymore.
I didn't hear anything on the mass media in the United States.
Well, they kind of smoked and mirrored the thing by saying, let's celebrate the space shuttles going into museums. And I'm going, well, are you out of your minds? Yeah. You're shutting down the space fleet. You're putting it in mothballs. You cut up the pads. Explain this to me. You got a $150 billion space platform floating around up in space, circling the Earth every 45 minutes. And it's called the ISS, International Space Station. Let's see, I think it circles every 90 minutes. But anyway, you got an orbiting space station. Now you have absolutely no way to get to it. And the only way we can get to it is beg for a ride on Russia's rockets. And that depends on what kind of mood Putin's in. And when he attacked Crimea and he told Obama, you guys want to get to that space station? Try a trampoline. So.
That's oh, really?
So you have no way of getting a human being into space right now. None.
Under whose watch was this done?
It's both Republican and Democrats' fault. Both parties. It started with Baby Bush and was finished off by Obama. And it was the shutting down and dismantling permanently the presence of a manned space program. And I could understand doing that if you had a set of new space shuttles sitting over here on a field ready to go, but there are no replacements, none planned, nothing. You just shut it down. Basically, you burnt the Nina and Santa Maria, and you burnt Columbus ships. We have no way of getting back up there, and no plans for it. So, and I know Trump's got something started, and I listened to it. It's just smoke and mirrors, you know. And then the other thing, let's go to Mars. Let's go to Mars. Do you know what it costs to go to Mars? $1.5 trillion would be the starting price. No. You know, go up from there.
And pardon me for David for interrupting, but would they have to rebuild those billions of dollars for those new for the launching pads that they just tore down?
Yeah, you'd have to rebuild everything because they destroyed everything. So. They know that. They know that it's now going to be cost prohibitive. So they know they're never going to have a manned Mars mission. Not in our lifetime. And my argument is, why in God's name do you want to go, you know, tens of millions of miles one way when here sets out only 240,000 miles away, even with our slow chemical rockets? You can get there in 3 days and explore the moon. Oh, we know everything about the moon. You don't know squat. If you take the 6 landing sites plus what the lunar rover vehicles went over, and all they did was just ride. They didn't stop and examine that much. They'd ride to certain points, A and B. But if you put all that together, it's about the size of an area of a super mall with its parking lots. Now, take that super mall with the parking lots and place it on the continent of North America. How much room does it take up? Not much. Times 2, because you have the backside of the moon. That is all that we have explored. We know nothing about the moon. But nobody wants to talk about going back to it. And I want to know, why is that?
You know, maybe I'm wrong on this, David, but I assume that the people who instigated this elimination of the space program, with all the launching pads and everything that were only partially used a little bit, in both the Bush and Obama administrations, were intelligent. Maybe I'm wrong in that assumption.
Right.
But why on earth do you think logically the reasons for that?
I can't come up with one. That's the problem. I can't give you a decent reason for doing all this. None of it makes sense. The only thing that makes sense is that, you know, you look at reality. Your ships are gone. They're museums. Your pads have been cut to pieces. You got nothing left. Now, none of that would make sense unless there was an alternate space program. I don't know if there is or not. But ironically, that's the only thing that really answers the question correctly. But which, if that's true, I would be so mad at them people if I ever met them, because who are you to sit on such technologies, control, and hoard it away,
right,
you know, for just a small group of people?
Right.
And that's where I would take real issue with them, because mm-hmm. nobody has the authority to do that. So basically, the one percenters took the space program for all to themselves. I didn't agree to that. Did you agree to it?
No. Never voted on it. No public discussion. Nothing.
Nothing. No debate. Not even a debate.
Right.
Never mentioned. Just done.
Right.
And, man, that's not the way we used to be. You know, we used to be, you know, a can-do nation. I'm 64, and the America I was born in is gone, just like the manned space program is gone.
Right.
Why they're doing it, I don't have a logical answer. But it sure leans to the theory there's an alternate space program.
And also, even if there is an alternative space program, which I think there is, David, why wouldn't you want to have the old system, the old shuttle system, as a backup in case something went wrong with the other program?
Exactly, or just combine them.
Yeah.
Then you have a very large base, and it's plenty to share.
Sure.
But no, none of the way they're behaving... it's just illogical unless there's an answer that would explain what they're doing. And but like I said, I've never seen any hardware, never talked to people that claim they work there, and I'd have to see documents and evidence and mm-hmm. you know, retirement programs. I mean,
yeah,
you know, come up, prove it. Is I get those two words a lot in my life,
right.
And that's why I made the video that I've got. I've made video evidence of all the stuff I've been telling you about my story. It's real. And people go, well, don't it bother you? People don't believe you? No, it don't. I don't care what you think out there. I didn't see you standing there next to me when I was building stuff. I didn't see you standing next to me when I had to blow everything to pieces, keep it from being a first strike weapon. And I know what I did, and that's enough for me. God knows what I did.
Sure.
That's all I care about. But for your sake, you really should get on the ball here and look at the stuff I'm telling you about. And look at the video. The video that I've made, it doesn't, you can't dismiss it. For instance, if you go to Ashland, Ohio, to John Ashbrook's Congressional Library, the curator will pull these letters out if you ask for them, and he'll show them to you. And the very first letter In the video, we walk up to the curator. He opens the door and brings out the letters. And the very first letter we focused on was written in June of 1970. And it says, Dear David, while you're, John Ashbrook's running for president, he's out of the office, we're in the process of obtaining the Titan missile for you. Now stop right there. This is written on congressional letterhead stationery, signed by the head of security of Congress. And it says, we're getting ready to hand over a Titan missile to you. I was born in 1954. This is 1970. How old am I? I'm 15. Don't you find it unusual handing a 130-foot tall ICBM missile over to a 15-year-old?
Yeah.
And the reason they were doing that was because I was building the engine, and General LeMay asked me, what kind of rocket body do you need? And I said, well, what's the biggest, baddest thing you got? And that was a Titan missile. And I told him, it takes a military escort to move this thing. It's 130 feet tall, 13 stories,
wow.
And got twin half-million-pound thrusting engines. And so I told LeMay, just hold it right for that, which was at Wright-Patterson. And it was so I went over and took a look at it and came back, and he asked me how would it work, and I said, well, I'll answer your question with a question. What is the last thing going through a mosquito's mind when he hits a windshield at 80 miles an hour? His ass.
Yeah.
Okay? That's what's going to happen if you put my rocket engine in this Titan. The engine will rip through the rocket. The rocket cannot possibly take the kind of gravitational G-force that this engine's going to put on it. So I had to build the rocket around the engine. So an entirely different looking type of rocket.
Wow.
But that's what that letter was all about.
Wow.
You know, how do you Photoshop a congressional letter laying in the congressional library?
Yeah.
You can't.
Right. David, you just told me something incredible. You said you rebuilt an alien engine. Could you tell my listeners a little bit about that?
Yeah, in the beginning, in 1968, when I built my first engine, it was it's an electromagnetic fusion containment engine, but people really don't quite get the picture when I say engine. I thought of a rocket engine, a way of validating if I've got field containment. It's actually a new type of nuclear reactor. It's a new energy source. The greatest thing about it is this engine. People say, it's no radiation. It's a thermonuclear device running that has no radiation. And so people, you're talking about cold fusion. No, this thing runs at 100 million degrees centigrade, 10,000 times hotter than the core of the sun. Does that sound cold?
No.
And what I can do is detonate a nuclear chain reaction, detonate an H-bomb and contain it. And people go, well, no such material could hold such a force. Well, you're right. It's electromagnetic fields. And these magnetic fields are shaped in a figure eight pattern, and I have containment. And people go, that's not possible. Oh, yeah, it's been possible. It's been going on for billions of years in space.
Wow.
Well, how's that? A black hole will swallow a sun. We've watched it. And a sun is hundreds of millions of nuclear weapons going off simultaneously on a continuous basis. And we watch a black hole pull up and just suck that thing in, it's gone.
Yeah.
So basically what I've been able to do is replicate an artificial black hole. And that's the containment of the engine. And there's several more phases I'm working on. But the basic design is my original design. But when they let me loose on top of the alien power plant that they had underground at Groom Lake, I remembered a great deal of things off of that. So when I rebuilt mine, I incorporated the alien's design.
Oh, interesting.
And it really works well. It runs really good. So you will see it. I have set up a system through open source across the planet. There are servers that has everything. It's taken me 45 years to get everything lined up. But on the day of my death, you will get dumped on the web, all of it. You'll get the blueprints, the schematics. You'll get the formulas. You'll get list of materials, tools you'll need, everything, right down to the screws of what to do.
Wow.
Someone will get it. Probably it'll be a, ironically, it'll probably be a third world country, have a little lab, and it's going to replicate it, and it's going to get the same results I did, thereby validating my technology. And then from that point on, it will change things all over the world, because imagine you're offered clean thermal fusion nuclear power with zero radiation.
Oh, my goodness. That's wonderful.
Well, that's what you'll get.
What do you think the reaction of the oil companies at the time will be?
They ain't going to be happy. It's history repeating itself. It'll be like Conestoga Wagon Company. And you walk in and say, you guys heard anything about it called a steam engine? You know, they ain't going to hear that. So this will. Here's what will happen to the oil companies. Once the countries start building these things and start implementing them through their systems, oil will become a lubricant, and that's it. No longer energy, just a lubricant.
And probably the value of oil will drop at least by 90%.
Oh, yeah, it will drop way down. Also, coal and gas will go.
Okay.
So there will be some real unhappy campers. Yeah, it's going to disrupt, you know, labor markets. Yeah, deal with it. We, just like through the past, we dealt with it. But when you get to the end of it, you'll be way better off than you ever before. Carbon footprints will stop just about.
I see. Wow.
So that's not too bad of a deal. So
wow.
Get to live on your planet for, you know, thousands of years, whereas right now you won't live more than 200 years on this planet.
Wow. I have to ask you, David, where do you think this engine came from? Do you know the race or species it came from?
Over the 45 years I've had time to analyze and process stuff. I don't know the name of the species. A lot of stuff I don't know about. But I do know this. They're not on any planet. They are in between the galaxies and in between interplanetary solar systems. So they're deep space. And for the longest time, we thought there was nothing out there. There are actually solar systems out there in between the galaxies. We just never found them. And these species originate out there. They're born there. They live there. And their lifespan is considerably different than ours. They don't live for thousands of millions of years. They're about 8 to 12 billion years old.
My goodness, that is old.
Yeah, and that also makes them, because of just longevity, they're one of the reigning species, because they outlived everybody, learned things. And I can't even comprehend if being an entity that's an sentient being, and I'm 8 billion years old. Can you imagine the knowledge you'd have?
Well,
because look at us. In the last 100 years, we have, you know, probably tenfold our knowledge from the first 5,000 years combined. So could you imagine a species that's 8 billion years old? How smart would they be?
And from what you know of them, David, are they benevolent?
And that's the oddest thing. Seems like the longer a being lives, the more benevolent it becomes. Maybe it has something to do with logic. I don't know. They like to see species evolve and become better. I never get a sense of malice on anything. You know, you want to control nothing. They don't want to own anything. They don't want to dictate. You know, they just want to live and interact with other beings.
Do they look like us? Are they in human form or another form?
No, they're in an entirely different form. We are a bipedal anthropoid body. You got trunks, a trunk, two legs, two arms, and a head. They don't even have a physical body form. They're more like energy. So the highest form of evolution that our evolutionists can say is that pure energy would be the most evolved that you could get. And that's pretty much how these things function. They're just pure energy, pure thought.
Mm-hmm.
So they're more biblical in nature.
Yeah.
They're more like spirit and beings than matter-oriented bodies, carbon units like us.
Who did they gift this technology to a government here on this planet, or was it captured by another species and then given to us? How? I mean, I'm just curious.
Well, yeah. So was I. And apparently, what happened when I got in the argument with the Air Force over it, I told them, you know, this thing is not ours and it's not theirs, meaning the Soviets. This thing's not even from the neighborhood, is it? And I said, did you shoot it down? Did you dig it up? You know, I don't even know how old the thing is. But clearly, they didn't create it because they brought me there to help them figure out how it works. And they were condescending and telling me things, and arguments started, but I knew that it wasn't theirs. But I don't know how old it is, how it got there. There is an impression I have that they were in some kind of pitch battle, and it was very simplistic. Evil versus good, dark versus light. And apparently the ship that this thing was in, and in proportion and size of the engine compared to the spacecraft had to be about the size of an aircraft carrier. So it was big. And the power plant, see the way it operates, the power plant, the engine, is an sentient entity of its own. It's just as individuals, me and you. The spacecraft is an sentient entity. It has its own personality. Then there's the crew. And all three of them, the power plant, the spacecraft, and the crew, all merged together in a tactile method. And they are a working symbiotic system. And the best way I could think of traveling through space would be just that, a symbiotic system. And apparently, that's how they function. And but I've got about a million questions I don't think I ever get answers to.
Yeah.
But the way this thing was built, that was another thing. The Air Force was so lost. My engine was about 6 feet long, and I had miles of wiring, nuts, bolts, screws, weld lines, seams. This thing was the size of an 18-wheel semi. Not one single bolt head, not one screw, not one rivet, not one weld line, no seams. It looked like an eggplant. It just grew. And I was trying to, it took me forever, but I was able to replicate that process. I believe the thing was constructed in a weightless environment because it's a long story, and once more, all the details, but I found a way through an accident that happened on Skylab. I've learned a way of shaping metal with sound waves, and people go,
metal with sound waves? That's incredible.
Well, yeah, it is. To me, it was just step by step of getting there. The hardest part I had was interlocking the vibrato waves. The vibrato waves were really difficult, but I figured out a system to do that. And in case you didn't know this, for every shape in a geometric universe, a square, a circle, a triangle, a rectangle, a trapezoid, there is a corresponding sound for that shape. So if you would scan something, you'll feed the data into a device that looks and operates like a mood synthesizer, but there's a mathematical computation translator in there that I built. And what it would allow to happen is that you can take the mathematical figures and numbers of a shape of something, and then it turns into, of all things, a song. You play the song, the sound waves come out on a six-sided speaker grid, a box, and the metal inside becomes an absolute twin of whatever it is you're fed into it. So if I scan my hand with a barcode reader, take those dimensions, put it in this translator, play the song, and have a glob of metal floating in a weightless environment, When the song plays, it becomes an absolute twin of what I just scanned.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, it. What's even more cool is what's happening with the metal on a molecular structure. When I first did this, there was a big argument that my metal was created in a weightless environment, comes into a 1G gravity field, and it'll be very brittle and just break up like peanut butter brittle. And I said, I don't think so. Because if you look inside metal, any kind of metal we have on a subatomic level, you'll see that the molecular structure is chaos. Because as the metal's cooling down in its casting shapes, the gravity convection fields of the Earth are pulling on it continuously. And you only get about a 30% blend. In space, in a weightless environment, with my sound waves device, I was able to lock in the molecular structure. And I cheated. I just took something already done. Mother Nature got the best subatomic structure I've ever seen. So why reinvent the wheel? I made a honeycomb structure on a molecular level inside the metal. Then when the metal was put under a stress test, it was no thicker than your thumbnail. But on a shear test, it had 1,000 times the strength of titanium. It weighed less than styrofoam of the same size. Wow. It's crystal clear. Welcome to 22nd century trans steel.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
And I have the patent on that. So I've got 26 different patents. And it's weird. It's like I built a Lamborghini in the year 1860. There's no oil refineries, so you can't do anything with it. It's just sitting there. You tie horses to it, and it makes a cool-looking cart. Uh-huh. I'll have to wait for the infrastructure to catch up for the Lamborghini to be full use. Well, that's with these 26 patents, that's the same problem. The infrastructure will have to get caught up, but when they get there, they're going to have to deal with me and my patents because I'm already sitting there.
Well, that's amazing. That's amazing, David. What do you see happening in the coming years? Do you see disclosure with the UFOs and all this technology?
We on a disclosure level, I was in the first disclosure of Stephen Greer. I was the very first one, and they sequestered me because I had a tendency, I guess, to steal too much thunder when I'm not trying to steal anything. I'm just trying to tell you what I'm doing. But, I've been hearing, well, let's see. I have to look at the dates, but I wrote a letter called A Disclosure on the Disclosure Project. And it's been, I think we did that in 1996 or 97. But anyway, 40 years, and Stephen Greer. Oh, we're gonna get disclosure. We're gonna get disclosure. Where is it? I haven't seen disclosure anywhere. It's not gonna happen. You're not gonna get disclosure until they're ready to do it. And when I say they, I ain't talking about human beings. I'm talking about whatever alien entities they've cut deals with. That's the third party. That's one they can't control. They'll decide when they do a disclosure, and I'll be who knows when.
Absolutely, absolutely.
As far as the future is for us, I don't like being pessimistic, but honestly, I don't see all that much good for us. Unless we get handles on ourselves and get things under control, remove this ungodly, mindless greed and control out of our society, we ain't gonna have no future.
Right.
You're gonna have just a small, tiny group of people that will have everything. And the rest of us going to be just living in a cesspool because we won't be able to move forward on anything. And the metaphysical community, who I really like the people, but some of the speakers get there and tell us, we're evolving, we're becoming greater and better. Is that so? Well, how about you come with me at 2 o'clock in the morning, let me take you through east side of L.A., and let me know how that evolved society works for you. It's madness out there. The only thing I've seen evolving are the metaphysical people who attend conferences. And everybody makes fun of the UFO people. Those people are actually evolving. And I may upset Christians when I tell them the rapture may come. And guess what? they'll come down here, and guess who they take? All the metaphysical people, and leave the rest of us here to deal with things. Because they're the only people I see evolving, and I've kept in touch with that community over the decades, and they are. They're, and there's generations of them. And that's all I see. But the sad part of it is, it's just a tiny fraction of them compared to the 8 billion of us. So just a very small fraction is evolving. So when people get up and speak and say, oh, the whole world is evolving, that bull crap. Go outside at 3 o'clock in the morning with a suit on and actually look what happens to you. You'll get robbed, raped, pillaged, rolled. I mean, it's, so no, it's not. We're not. If anything, we're de-evolving. So we're becoming more of a savage race, except for the metaphysical communities. They're doing good. I like them. That's why I take time out to talk to them, because I find metaphysical audiences so far ahead. When I say something, I don't have to explain so much. To scientists, I'll have to explain everything, draw stuff on boards, pull out slides, photographs, all that stuff, you know, and draw them a picture, where the metaphysical audiences all nod, yeah, we get this. And I just have a lot of fun with that.
Yeah.
So they're good people.
Well, thank you, David. I appreciate the compliment.
Well, yeah, you people are all right. And I wish the federal government, the Congress, the senators were all metaphysical. Wouldn't that change things? Then we would evolve.
Well, yeah, that's true. Absolutely.
So.
Absolutely. I've looked at the historical record, and also in the animal and plant kingdoms, and I can't find any evidence, David, for any distinctions between Republicans and Democrats in the plant and animal world.
Yeah. No, it's a miracle we even survive as a species. Mm-hmm. I don't think we even originated on this planet. Because you take a puppy and put it in a small cardboard box, that puppy will hold itself till it's about dead and not doing one or two business in there, because it had to lay in it. Human beings, they'll just do it all over the place. And another thing, animal kingdom, when an infant's born, it hits ground walking, you know, and stays with the herd. You take a human being, baby, throw it out on the ground, it'll lay there and die. In its own crap, and can't do nothing. Right. And yet, once it gets old enough, becomes the dominant species on the planet. Right. We don't fit the profile of this planet. And the way we conduct ourselves, I think we were born and raised on a Tupperware planet. Something that could withstand all the corrosive crap we do. We don't belong here. We really don't.
Interesting. David, I wanted to ask you, how did you get involved in all of this? I know that's a $64 million question, and it takes more than 25 words, but...
Yeah. Well, I've been working at it for 64 years, and I'm still trying to figure that answer.
Yeah.
I just came into this world kind of strange. Lord have mercy, I was born in Welch, West Virginia. I'm not only a redneck, I'm a hillbilly redneck. You don't get no worse than that. And I was born to... I'm a coal miner's son, and my dad was illiterate. He got a fifth grade education before his parents pulled him out of school and made him work. And there I was sitting in number 10 district, Pocahontas Coal Fields, and in West Virginia. And I'm 7 years old, and I'm working quantum physics differential mechanics.
Quantum, did you just pick up a textbook and decide to read it for fun during the weekends or evenings?
Well, yeah, what I would do, when I got chores done, whatever, I'd go to the public library, and I sat in a corner over in the 600 sections, and it's all the technical books, and I would sit on the floor up in the corner of the bookshelves, and I'm little, I'm only like seven, and I'm reading all these books, and a librarian came over, Mrs. Hunt, and she looked at me, and she goes, are you reading these books? And I said to her, well, they don't have pictures in them. And I really didn't mean any disrespect. She just kind of humped at me, and she goes, do you remember what's in these books? I said, yeah. How many of them have you read? And all of them. About 400 books. He says, well, how much do you remember? Everything. So she just reaches over my head and jerks out this book, and she opens it up and she goes, the beginning introduction of this book, what's it say? I said, well, let me see the title. So she shows me a title, and it was singularities and other astronomical events. And I said, oh, okay. Yeah, a singularity it's a graviton well that is controlled by the collapsing of a star, normally a neutrino. It has an invariable reduction system across the event horizon. And she slams the book shut and she goes, okay, good enough. You got everything word for word. And she asked, would you like to read more books? I said, yeah, but you'd have to order them. I have no way of doing that. And she said, why don't you come back this afternoon? And I did. And she said, you're going to be an assistant librarian. I said, well, it's all girls. So here's a picture of the librarians, and I'm the only male standing in the middle of them. I'm little. But she did that because she said, you can order any book you want now. And I ordered probably 700-800 books in the first year, read them all, sent them back, get more. So she really, and she was smart. This little lady might have been a West Virginian librarian, and she was smart, though. She said, don't tell a single soul about what you know. She said, just talk like the other kids, I like Mickey Mantle and Roger Maris and that kind of stuff. But don't do the science thing. And she didn't say why, but I figured out she did use a word. She said, you will be ostracized, that you'll never recover. I had to go look that word up. And I went, boy, that don't sound good. So I kept quiet and just ordered my books and played baseball with the other kids and never talked about this stuff.
Wow. And, wow. So what happened, like, when you were 10? By that time, were you getting nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize at that point?
No, I was, what phrase is today, I kept under radar. But it was my dad that was a game changer. There's a movie called October Sky. And the star in that is a guy named Homer Hickman, a real person. He was born 3 miles from where I was born. He's born in Colwood. I was born in Welch. And he built rockets and finally got out of the coal fields because he was never going to get a football scholarship. Homer couldn't play football for crap. And but he went the civilian route. I ended up in a more of a military vein is how I got out. But what happened, my dad he was a catalyst. He started the whole thing. In that movie, October Sky, Homer's father is talking to the mine superintendent, an elderly man in a black suit. That man is, in real life, his name is James Hightower. That is my mother's father. That's my grandfather in that movie. Wow. So I'm tied very closely to the story. So my grandfather, being the mine superintendent, didn't want his grandchildren have no father due to coal mine accidents, which was very frequent. So my dad was a gifted mechanic. Illiterate or not, it don't matter. He could do mechanics like, God, nobody's business. So the grandfather provided a gas station, and my dad started a mechanic service station. And he had a smash hit business from day one, and the best customers came in at 3 o'clock in the morning, and people would mother and dad would hang up the blankets over the windows so you couldn't see the lights on, because these cars would pull in. They had 200 gallon tanks in the trunk, and it's not gasoline, it's moonshine. They're moonrunners. Under the hood was a 392 Chrysler Hemi engine. My dad would tune them up till they're like missiles, because they hide the lights, because revenuers are looking for garages who's turning out these high-powered cars that they're trying to chase and catch. And those drivers later become NASCAR's champions. That's where NASCAR got started, from the Moon Runners. And go look it up in NASCAR. You'll find that is absolutely correct. So what happens is with that, what became of that was my dad, you know, just became so fast at tuning these cars up and fixing them because you want them in and out so the revenuers don't see the garage. And they've always paid in cash. They were the best customers. So one day this man came through, and you're probably, everybody's sitting there going, what's this got to do with his story? A lot. Because here's what happened. Dad's got his garage going. This man pulls in. He's got a busted Spicer carburetor. Very complicated. Big four barrel. Got a water jacket built around it. Takes about half a day to change the thing. Dad looked at it and said, I can change that in an hour. He said, really? He says, I've got another spare one. I'll change it out for you. He said, can I watch you? He said, sure. So Dad just did it right out there in the daylight, and he got it done in about an hour, 10 minutes, something like that. And the man said, do you always work this fast? He goes, yeah, when I see what I'm doing. He didn't get the joke about light and dark. Anyway, the man said, I'm coming from Detroit. I'm on my way to Daytona Beach. We're going to race cars down there. I'm going to hire you as my mechanic. Hi, my name is Lee Petty. He has a son named Richard Petty.
Oh, wow.
The greatest NASCAR drivers on earth. Sure. My dad became Lee Petty's mechanic. And that put me in the Petty shops. Wow. And what is a NASCAR speed shop and a NASA rocket shop are mirrors of each other.
Oh, wow.
They got the same machines, the same materials. And since we ran drag racers, we had the same fuels. We had liquid nitrogen, methane, nitro. And so my dad put me to work in the garages. I really didn't like doing that, but it helped my skill set. But the first engine I built was a 426 Chrysler Hemi engine with two four barrels, 900 horsepower. It won the Grand National.
Wow.
And I'm 12
Amazing.
Years old.
Just 12 years old, my goodness.
Yeah, and my dad said, boy, wait till they find out about this. And Lee Petty and Richard Petty went, Fred, we can't tell anybody about this. We got two big problems. One is it's got this thing called child labor laws. He's only 12. And the second one, see that man over there? His name is Bill France, chairman of NASCAR. He'll hang us from them trees over there. And we can't, so, you understand, Dave, you can't tell anybody. I said, yeah, it's okay. So Richard looked at me and said, oh, I feel kind of bad about this. Well, anything we can do for you? Could I use the shops at night? And I said, give him a set of keys and codes to security, and anything in this shop you don't find, tell us, write it down, we'll get it for you. And my first rocket I built was a cryogenic pumper. It's a liquid fuel rocket engine. The temperature of the fuels are 325 degrees below zero. But we had all the equipment and handling machinery for that. And my first rocket I built that came out of that shop, when we launched it, it hit about 56,000 feet. That's over 10 miles. And it was clocking at nearly 3,000 miles an hour. And that was my very first rocket that I built. People, when they say the very first rocket, you know, it's like a little Estes rocket, and no, man, my thing, when it took off, it burned an area the size of a football field to a crisp. And it went thundering out of there. And that's how I was able to build such sophisticated rockets, because all the machinery and hardware I needed was right there.
Mm-hmm.
So now people be wondering, how does a NASCAR mechanic got to do with this? Everything. And it answers things logically. How did a 12-year-old get to do all this?
Sure.
I just evolved to it.
That's amazing.
Isn't David Adair a fascinating man? I felt so privileged and honored to be able to talk to him and interview him live. He was at Yelm, Washington at a UFO fest there a couple weeks ago. And anyway, I've got another hour of his interview that I'll be playing here in a few minutes. In the meantime, I wanted to tell everyone that if you are in the Ocean Shores area this weekend, I'll be there on Saturday and Sunday giving readings. And also I'll be giving out materials on a wonderful program being done by my friend Tom Tom Palladino. He uses Tesla technology to heal people. And what he does, he'll take your person's photograph, and he'll run it through his machinery at home, and it'll really help the person with any physical or spiritual condition. At any rate, I hope to get on Tom now to talk a little bit about his program. It's a free program. The first 15 days are free, and I've had a lot of really good response from it. Tom actually works on vibrations and on his theory behind his healing program is to correct people's vibrations. Once you correct the vibrations, you're able to help them in a physical or a spiritual way. It's the same principle with the Hado machines used by the Emoto, similar to the Emoto office uses, Dr. Emoto's office uses in Tokyo, Japan. Michiko Hayashi uses those machines. She'll take somebody's hand, for example, and put it on a pad, electronic pad, and that pad will help program water, which the person drinks, and that can help correct their vibrations, which can help them with any physical or spiritual condition. So it does work. I've seen it work before for many, many people, and Tom's a wonderful guy. I hope we can get him on soon. I said we'd be calling him at 3. It's a little bit early. In the meantime, while Nathan is a wonderful guy, he's doing my producing today. Eric's on vacation. I wanted to tell everyone, of course, I'll be going to Mount Shasta, California next month from September 6th to the 12th. It's a fascinating trip. The cost is just $200 per person and includes free dry camping. Of course, there's been some fires down in the area, but they're not affecting Mount Shasta. There's been some smoke, of course, from the fires in Mount Shasta, but it's not preventing anyone from going. And I want to tell you that if you are coming on the trip, don't worry. The fires have not affected Mount Shasta at all. I don't know if people have been noticing this, but on the YouTube there has been videos of particle beam weapons being used as part of the fires. But we'll go into that next week on another show. And my producer just told me that Tom Palladino is on the line. Tom, are you there?
I am. Hi, Ted. Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine, Tom. Yeah, we called you a little early. We've got about two or three minutes left. But I want to talk about your program now and then keep you over to start you off at the beginning of the next hour. Tom, what's your website so people could check out your wonderful healing program?
The website is scalarlight.com, S-C-A-L-A-R, light.com.
Okay, great. Great. And it's a free program that you have for healing. How does it work? People send a picture in and then you run it through your machines and they're helped?
That's correct. I'm working with Scalar Energy, so I can work remotely. I can work by way of a person's photograph. All I need is a photograph of your skin, your anatomy. And in so doing, we can improve your health. We can balance your chakras and we can break apart, we can disassemble the germs in your body.
You know, this sounds like you are hundreds of years ahead of what we do now on this planet to help people.
It is forward thinking, Ted, but it's gaining popularity. It is catching hold, if you will. This is the new medical paradigm, and we need a new medical paradigm. Because the United States of America spends $4 trillion on health every year, and we're not getting healthier. We need a new way of looking at health and wellness.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tom, I couldn't agree with you more, my friend. Could you hold on over the top of the hour, and we'll bring you back on. We can talk about your program. I actually will be out at Ocean Shores, Washington, this week in a little health and wellness fair out there, and I'll have lots of pamphlets and information about Tom's program as well. So, Tom, if you could please hold on for a few minutes, we'll have you on the top of the next hour, and then we'll continue with the interview with David Adair. Please stay tuned, friends.